Welcome to the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. I'm Rabbi Mark Wyshovsky, and this is the 12-minute shiur number 7, Prayer in Translation. Is it kosher? Part 1. In the early 19th century, when the movement for Jewish religious reform got off the ground in Central Europe, one of its first innovations was to institute public prayer in the vernacular language. The opponents of the Reform movement, soon to be called Orthodox, protested that this innovation violated the Halakha. The Reformers responded, "No, Halakha is on our side. In fact, it permits us to recite our liturgy and worship in a language we understand." To this day, the language of prayer remains a major point of division between Reform and Progressive Jews, who conduct much of their service in the vernacular, and just about everybody else for whom Hebrew remains the dominant language of worship. In the following set of shiurim, we'll explore the halachic implications of what was and remains a controversial change in Jewish practice. As always, the source sheet for this shiur is available on our website. We begin with the text on lines 3 through 9, Mishnah Sota, Chapter 7, Mishnah 1. It lists those liturgical texts and formulae that may be recited in any language, Elu ne'marin b'chol lashon, to be distinguished from those that must be recited b'shon ha'kodesh, in Hebrew. We're focusing on the ones in bold font, Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, which according to the Mishnah may be recited in any language. The Talmud in Sota 32b and 33a explains why this is so. First, Kriyat Shema, lines 14 through 27. Kriyat Shema menalan dichtiv Shema Yisrael b'chol lashon she'ata shomea. How do we know that the Shema may be recited in any language? Because it is written in Deuteronomy chapter 6, Shema, hear, O Israel, which means in any language you hear or understand. The word shomea in the Midrash, suggesting that Shema means to understand as well as to audibly hear something. Now the text goes on to show that this Midrash represents one side of a machloket, a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the sages. The halakha follows the sages, they're in the majority, and the Shulchan Aruch, lines 32 through 35, confirms this. But look what he says at the very end. V'yizaher midivrei shibush sheba'oto lashon, v'yidakdek bo kmo bilshon hakodesh. One may recite the Shema in any language, provided that one avoids mistakes in that language and is precise in its usage as one would be with the Hebrew. The Talmud doesn't mention this requirement of dikduk, of precision in the non-Hebrew language of the Shema. The requirement originates with Rambam in his Mishneh Torah. It's repeated here in the Shulchan Aruch, and it's going to be significant as we continue in our series. But for now, it's enough to say that, according to classical halakha, the Torah itself permits us to recite Shema in the vernacular. Well, what about tefillah? Let's go back to the Talmud, Sota 33a, that's line 38 and then 44 and 45 in on the source sheet. Tefillah rachamehi, kol hechi deba'e mitzale. How do we know that the tefillah may be recited in any language? Because it's an act of rachame, of supplication, so that one may pray in any language one wishes. Rashi, lines 56 through 60, tells us, this shows we don't need a scriptural proof text to establish that the tefillah may be recited in any language. We had such a proof text with Shema, we don't with tefillah, because by its very nature, supplication requires understanding. Vahahu lishna diyada likhaven libo litzle. Let one pray in the language in which one can form intention, that is, kavana, without which one's tefillah is hardly a prayer at all. We find this same insight in the Sefer Chasidim, the 12th century compilation of Musar, Halakha, and Minhag, as practiced by the Chasidei Ashkenaz. It's on lines 65 through 73. If you should encounter a man who doesn't understand Hebrew, but is God-fearing and wishes to pray with kavanah v'yiltzeh l'chaven, or if you should encounter a woman. Okay, the presumption in those days, of course, was that women who usually didn't receive a formal education did not know Hebrew. If you encounter any of these people, tell them to learn the prayers in a language that they understand. Ki hatfilah eina ela b'havanat halev. For prayer rests entirely upon one's understanding. And if one's mind doesn't understand what one's mouth is saying, what good is the prayer? For this reason, tov sheyitpalel ba'oto lashon shehu mevin, it's better to pray in the language that one understands. So not only is it permitted to pray in the vernacular, according to Sefer Chasidim, it's preferable to do so if you don't understand Hebrew and can form kavanah only in a language that you do speak. Does this mean that there are no halachic problems whatsoever with prayer in the vernacular? Well, not so fast. Let's go back to the Talmud passage in Sota, which begins on lines 39 and 46. The Talmud asks, Tefillah b'chol lashon, is it so that we may pray in any language? But Rav Yehuda says, one should never offer a supplication, pray for one's needs, literally, in Aramaic. For as Rabbi Yochanan says, if one should pray in Aramaic, the ministering angels pay no attention to him because they don't understand that language. You see, the angels, according to this idea, are the ones who bring our words before God, which they can't do if they don't understand what we're saying. So how can it be that we're allowed to pray in any language? The Talmud answers the kusha by saying, La kasha, that's not a difficulty. Rav Yehuda, who says we can't pray in Aramaic, is referring to one who prays alone, while the Mishnah, which says we may pray in any language, is referring to one who prays with a congregation. Rashi there tells us that God listens directly to public prayer, tefilatan shel rabim, and therefore doesn't need the angels to act as intermediaries, as they presumably have to do when the tefillah is that of someone who doesn't daven with a minyan. It appears then that there's something of a problem if we pray in Aramaic. Okay, big deal, who does that anymore? But Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, the towering 11th century North African and Spanish posek, in his reading of the text, we see this on lines 76 through 81, does conflate Aramaic with all non-Hebrew languages. The Yachid, the one who prays by himself without a minyan, may pray only in Hebrew, says Alfasi, presumably because the ministering angels, the Malachei Hasharet, do not understand any language but Hebrew. Now, this reading contradicts the plain sense of the Sota passage, and it's refuted in our next excerpt from Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel, the Rosh, who died in 1327. It's on lines 86 through 116. He tells us that Rabbi Yonah Gerondi, in his commentary on Alfasi that was edited by his students, raised the following difficulty. Well, if the individual may pray only in Hebrew, as Alfasi says, how do we explain the universal minhag, nahagu kol ha'olam, the Hebrew text is in bold font, for women to pray in the vernacular? Since they are halachically obligated to pray, well, that is once a day traditionally, if not three times, they too should pray only in Hebrew. Thus we have evidence not only that women were reciting the tefillah in the vernacular during the Middle Ages, but that their practice was deemed to fulfill a halachic requirement. Well, the sages of France were on line 102, defended that minhag. Since we're talking about the tefillah that the congregation recites, then we consider it the prayer of the congregation, even when an individual says it without a minyan, and accordingly that person may recite it in a language other than Hebrew. In other words, the fixed liturgical tefillah is always considered tefillat hatzibur, public prayer, even when it's not being recited in a congregation. Now, as for Rav Yehuda's statement that one should never offer a supplication in Aramaic, that refers, for example, to a prayer for a sick person or over some household distress or some other personal need. But as for the fixed prayer, the kavua prayer, like the Amidah, When an individual recites it at home, it is as though he or she recited it with a minyan, and that person does not need an interpreter to bring his prayer before the Holy One. So Rabbi Yonah modifies Al-Fasi, but did not reject entirely his assertion that all non-Hebrew languages have the status of Aramaic. That, however, is what the Rosh does, because he goes on, it seems to me that there's no difficulty here. Rav Yehuda is speaking specifically about the Aramaic language. As Tosafot tells us, it can't be true that Malachei Hasharet makirim bilshon ha'arami, she'ein Malachei Hasharet makirim bilshon ha'arami. It can't be true that the ministering angels don't know Aramaic. After all, they know our innermost thoughts. Rather, they regard Aramaic as a lowly, contemptible language and refuse to hear it. So Rosh restores the acceptability of vernacular prayer. The problem with Aramaic is that it's Aramaic, but that problem does not attach to any other language. And therefore, for personal prayer, as well as for the statutory tefillah, for individuals, as well as for congregations, the vernacular is just fine, so long as it's not Aramaic. Now, the codified halakha, at least in the 16th century, is stated in the Shulchan Aruch, and that's in lines 119 through 131. Here we find all three halachic positions, that of Al-Fasi, that of Rabbeinu Yonah, and that of the Rosh, represented. And while Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, does not clearly decide among them, it's a fact that all three positions permit the recitation of the formal public synagogue tefillah in the vernacular language. Clearly then, if the Shema and the tefillah, the two major rubrics of our liturgy, may be recited in the vernacular, then the 19th century reformers had some strong halachic support for their innovation. The story, however, does not end here, and we'll explore why in the next installments of the 12-Minute Shiur. Thanks for learning with us.